from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up,
it's wholly appropriate for the president to share whatever information he thinks is necessary to advance the security of the American people. That's what he did.
The White House scrambles after President Trump tweets that he did share intelligence with the Russians. We'll get responses from Washington and a top national security expert. Also today, the robot revolution is here.
Computers were programmed to swap out error-prone, inconsistent human calculation with digital perfection.
Perfection, maybe, but some economists say that the robot revolution is not making the economy more productive. Plus,
halfway point of the fourth quarter of Game 7. Olynyk again! Kelly Olynyk!
The Celtics are headed to the Eastern Conference Finals. Next up, a showdown with LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's been less than 24 hours since the Washington Post broke that huge story about President Donald Trump sharing highly classified intelligence with the Russian foreign minister and ambassador in a White House meeting last week. First, the White House, including National Security Advisor Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, issued a fierce denial of that story. They did that yesterday evening. Then this morning, President Trump tweeted what amounts to a denial of the denial. He proudly admitted sharing the intelligence, tweeting, quote, "I have the absolute right to do so." So this afternoon, McMaster stepped to the podium again.
What the president discussed with the foreign minister was wholly appropriate to that conversation and is consistent with the routine sharing of information between the president and any leaders with whom he's engaged.
Not long after that, the president himself spoke at a joint press conference with the Turkish president.
As General McMaster said, I thought he said, and I know he feels, that we had actually a great meeting with the foreign minister. So we're going to have a lot of great success over the next coming years.
Well, let's get reaction from Washington and a leading national security analyst. But first, to Massachusetts Congressman Bill Keating. And Congressman, you just heard General McMaster say that the president's actions were wholly appropriate. Your reaction?
Well, I couldn't disagree more. There's much at stake here right now. And number one, the credibility, the Russia issue, the silence by so many of my Republican colleagues to a series of events that really calls into question whether or not our government can rise to the occasion of having the confidence restored in our security. This is sharing information, divulging secrets to one of our biggest enemies. It's endangering lives. It's endangering our security at home, and it's also causing irreparable damage, I believe, to many of our allies that are sharing information. Now, the information in question here, there was a promise made that it be kept with the U.S., not even shared with our other allies. That's obviously been breached. So I think that there'll be a chilling effect on the sharing of information. And also, we're going to be hopefully briefed as I go back to Washington about the specifics in terms of whether or not some informants' lives are indeed jeopardized themselves.
And will that briefing come in your capacity as a member of the House Homeland Security Committee?
We're hopeful. I think this really is something that should be for all members. I'm ranking member on the Terrorism Subcommittee on Foreign Affairs as well as Homeland Security, so things that are relevant to these particular issues. I'm privy to certain classified information, and you know, we take an oath not to divulge that information. I understand early in a president's tenure where people that are on the same side as the aisle try and be understanding. But we're far beyond that. We're at an issue of security that does endanger lives. I think we're at the point where that silence becomes enabling. You know, we're a check on the system. Congress is a check on these matters. And if we continue to acquiesce with silence, we're not doing our job.
Congressman, let me ask you, just to be clear, do you think President Trump acted outside of his capacity or duty as president when he shared that information with the Russians?
Well, he is commander-in-chief, as every president is, and as a result, they're privy to all the classified information, as they should be at the highest level. There's a procedure in place, and it was that way with President Reagan. It was with President Bush when certain information was going to be surfaced regarding classified information. That didn't occur here. It happened just as a result of the conversation the president was having. It happened extemporaneously. There's a great deal to be concerned with. This isn't just Donald Trump being Donald Trump. This is serious.
Hmm. Well, Congressman Bill Keating represents Massachusetts' 9th District. Congressman, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you, Megan.
Well, some former members of the national security establishment are speaking out. Here's Leon Panetta, former Secretary of Defense and CIA Director under President Obama. He was on CNN.
This is not just a joke. This is very serious business that relates to the security of this country. This president needs to have some grown-ups around him that make very clear what the lines are here.
Well, one of those people is the highly regarded Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor. And again today, McMaster defended the president.
I was in the room. The Secretary of State was in the room, as you know. The Deputy Advisor for National Security, Dina Powell for Strategy, was in the room. And none of us felt in any way that conversation was inappropriate.
Well, let's turn now to Admiral James Stavridis. He's the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and he's former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO in Europe. Admiral Stavridis, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Magna.
Well, Admiral, first of all, I mean, you know Lieutenant General McMaster well. Help us understand what he's going through right now. How do you interpret his defense of the president?
It's hard to quantify. Let's do the numbers. Last night, he came out and effectively said no classified material was passed. This morning, the president contradicted him in a tweet and said, yeah, actually, I gave that information to the Russians. And then General McMaster came out, and now the story is, well, it's not that important. It was a good conversation. Look, Magna, I think there are three things that have gone badly wrong here. One is tactical. We've placed a source in real danger, in my view. That can have consequence for us here in the United States. Secondly, our allies are going to be less likely to share information with us. Think how we would feel if Chancellor Merkel of Germany passed classified material that we had shared with the Germans to the Russians. And thirdly, and worst of all, the real winners are the Russians. Mm-hmm. They managed to blow up Washington again. They divide us. They create real controversy, and we can't address the problems we need to go after, North Korea, the Islamic State, and so on.
Right. So, Admiral, help me understand something. The New York Times is just now reporting that there's fear among some of Mr. Trump's senior advisors, including General McMaster, about leaving the president alone in meetings with foreign leaders out of concern that he might speak out of turn. I mean, if that is indeed the case, how is Lieutenant General McMaster, the National Security Advisor, how is he able to do his job?
He can only do his job with a cooperative president. And I've worked in and around near 10 national security advisors over the years at different levels of my career. And the common trait they share when they are successful is that they have a mental bond with the president. And I think that the president's approach is so scattershot, so up and down, so in and out, that it's going to be very difficult for General McMaster to master that, not to make a pun.
Right. So, I mean, as former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, Admiral, I presume you've handled intelligence at the highest levels. I mean, I'm asking you honestly, if you were working in this administration right now, and you had to brief the president, would you trust him with the information you were giving him?
You'd have to. The system won't work otherwise. I think what General McMaster and General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, need to do, and also General Kelly over at Homeland Security, who deals with a lot of highly classified material, they need to constantly and consciously warn the president and talk to him. And I think hopefully this entire episode will be something of a cautionary tale, although let's face it, other controversies haven't modified President Trump's behavior very much.
I mean, do we have a fully functioning national security apparatus right now if the commander-in-chief is essentially, as General McMaster said today, kind of just giving away intelligence off the cuff in meetings?
We have a less capable national security apparatus. Despite the contretemps that we see in the White House today, I think we have a very capable Secretary of Defense. We have a very capable Secretary of Homeland Security. I think the Secretary of State is growing into his role as well. So there are grown-ups, if you will, in the government. The question is, can they come together and produce a presidency that actually has coherent strategy? That remains to be seen.
So this is all coming in, of course, at an extraordinarily important and interesting time. The New York Times is reporting that the intelligence originally came from Israel, and that, in fact, it was of such a highly delicate and sensitive nature that it was requested that the intelligence not even be shared with other members of the government. And now, in the coming days, the president is making a trip to the Middle East, including to Israel. I mean, what is likely to happen when he goes there?
Publicly, both the Israelis and the Saudis will treat the president with respect. Privately, their senior people are talking to our senior people and undoubtedly saying this can never happen again. However, the public face that will be placed on this will be a positive one. But you can only go to this well so many times, Magna. And I think that without question, this episode will have a chilling effect on not only the Israelis, but the Jordanians, the Turks, NATO members. People are going to be very loath to share this information, and frankly, with good reason at this point.
And tell me more about what impact that's going to have on U.S. national security.
We rely on our partners, friends, and allies around the world to help us complete the mosaic. What I mean by that is intelligence is not like a photograph. It's like a mosaic where individual little colored pieces fit in and all of a sudden the picture makes sense to you. We can't do that by ourselves. We need our partners and friends to help us fill in the mosaic. They're going to withhold bits and pieces because they're afraid of leaks and afraid they will be burned and their sources will be burned. That will diminish our security immeasurably, particularly in counterterrorism.
Now, just to be clear, since there may be some confusion around this, I mean, Admiral Stavridis, do you believe that the president stepped outside of his authority, even as commander-in-chief, in sharing this intelligence with the Russians?
No. He, as the commander-in-chief, can instantly, on the spot, declassify intelligence and share it. He didn't step out of his legal authority. He stepped out of the boundaries of good judgment. And I think that over time, that if he continues that behavior, it will have a very deleterious effect on our security.
So do you think that there should be any kind of response from Congress? I mean, how do we right this ship?
I think the role of Congress, as Representative Keating was mentioning earlier, and as many other voices are being raised on the Hill, will be, A, to follow this Russian investigation wherever the facts lead. Because part of this whole aspect that makes this so distasteful as an incident is this whiff of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. So Congress has to follow those facts. And secondly, Congress has the authority to pass resolutions, to exert a certain level of control over the budget process, which can be very salutary in focusing the mind of the executive branch. So Congress is not without tools to respond here.
Well, that's Admiral James Stavridis. He's the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He also is former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO in Europe. He served in that position from 2009 to 2013. Admiral, thank you as always.
What a pleasure, Magna. Talk soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, back at the White House, Press Secretary Sean Spicer just gave the daily press briefing a little over an hour ago, and he says the administration's chief concern right now is who leaked the original story to the press.
The idea that someone who has been given access to information is pushing that information out into the media is undermines our national security, and I don't think there's any other way to say it.
All right, well, let's get some reaction from Congressman Mike Capuano. He joins us now on the line. Congressman, welcome back to the show.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, so it's been a heady 24 hours. You just heard what Admiral James Stavridis had to say. I mean, what do you think Congress's role should be right now?
Well, I would like some of my colleagues in Congress to speak up as well. I think the Democrats are pretty loud about what's going on. A handful of Republicans, especially in the Senate, have had some things to say, but they have not yet taken a leadership position on what to do about it. Absolutely, Congress should be standing on its high heels. screaming as loud as possible. And that's not necessarily a conviction. But we have now several things going on. We have the potential hacking of the election. We have a questionable firing of the FBI director for possibly the wrong reason. Now we have leaks in the White House on sensitive information, all of which I think demand and deserve direct answers. That doesn't imply that there has been some kind of a breach of the law, but certainly there has been enough to ask questions about the proprietary information, the proprietariness of the of what's gone on.
Mm. Senator Susan Collins of Maine has said that the Senate Intelligence Committee has asked for a briefing, a detailed briefing on exactly what happened. But Congressman Capuano, I mean, how long can this go on? How long can the White House function with this level of chaos and back and forth and denial? I mean, how can it go on?
They're not functioning. That's just it. And to be perfectly honest, I, like everybody else, expected some degree of choppiness for a new administration. But this is just endless. And to be perfectly honest, I'm one of the many people that kind of think each and every time something happens, I figure, okay, they've learned their lesson. It's going to get smoother tomorrow. And the next day, it gets significantly more choppy on the next issue. Leaking intelligence issues intentionally to the Russians, that's got to be the most questionable aspect thus far. And I can't imagine I would have said that a week ago, because I thought maybe firing the FBI director in the middle of an investigation was the top of the cake. They just keep topping themselves. So I'm not so sure that a briefing of the Senate or the House Intelligence Committees in a closed, secure room is going to answer the questions that have really been placed out there.
Well, so then how then can you and other members of Congress push to get those answers?
Well, we're going to keep pushing. Right now, unfortunately, the Republicans run the House and the Senate, and when you run a body, you get to determine the agenda and how things get done. And until a handful of Republicans demand that the Senate and the House become Americans before they become party affiliates, probably nothing will happen. And many of us will continue to have to just scream into the wind. But right now, there's not much else we can do under the current situation.
Well, House Speaker Paul Ryan's office sent out a statement in which it was written that, quote, "We have no way to know what was said, but protecting our nation's secrets is paramount. The speaker hopes for a full explanation of the facts from the administration." Arizona Senator John McCain also tweeted, "If true, this is deeply disturbing." And today he told CNN, "I take General McMaster at his word." So talk to me about that for a second, because the National Security Advisor stood before the press and the people today and said it was appropriate.
The president has now repeatedly thrown his own people under the bus on every single issue. First, McMaster came out and said, nope, didn't happen. And then the president said, yes, it did. I did it. I'm proud of it. And McMaster came out and said he had every right to do it. Now, I am not the constitutional expert on national security matters, what the president can do. It has been reported, and I will accept it for the moment, that the president is not breaking any laws when he himself commits an act that would be treason if committed by anybody else. I will accept that. That still doesn't make it right. McMaster has lost credibility now because the president changed his story in a matter of hours behind the back of his own appointee, and a well-respected general. So how does he have any credibility with the public, and how does Ryan have any credibility anymore? This absolutely is a continuing demand for independent investigation of these matters. They seem to be related. It could be one investigation. And I want to say I am not using the word independent prosecutor, because that presumes an answer. I am using the words independent investigation. And that is within the authority of the Congress or the authority of the Attorney General to do.
Congressman Michael Capuano, he represents Massachusetts' 7th District. Congressman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The robots are coming. Are you going to be automated out of a job? Well, that is a big and important question with the rise of the robot revolution. But we've been told that replacing humans with machines makes companies more efficient. It means more for less at the industry level, and in turn, the savings should be passed on to people. Everyone wins. So we've been told. But according to two economists at MIT and Boston University, the reality is not quite so rosy. Instead, despite increasing numbers of industrial robots and automation in the United States, productivity growth is at a historic low. And the people who've been losing their jobs to automation, they are not getting new ones. So where is that robot utopia we were promised? Joining us now is Evan Horowitz. He tackles the question, or this question, in his piece for the Boston Globe. It was titled, "Why Aren't Robots Boosting Economic Productivity?" And he joins us now in the studio. It's great to have you back, Evan.
It's great to be here and to be talking about something other than scandal in D.C.
Indeed. We're just talking about the end of work for humans instead. All right. So before we get to this question of the robot revolution and productivity, just let's start with a little bit of context here. I mean, how far along are we in terms of the second machine revolution, as it's been called by some folks at MIT, in terms of replacing human work?
Well, it's happening. The robots are coming. There's been about a five-fold increase in the number of these sort of reprogrammable industrial machines since about 1990. That's a big jump. It's still the early stages, but you'd expect to start seeing some of the effects. And the fact that we can't see positive effects is already, I think, a little troubling.
Okay, interesting. So in your piece, you reported, got some numbers here, that the use of, as you said, of industrial robots has grown by fivefold since the 90s, adding up to what, 1.75 robots for every 1,000 workers?
Exactly.
Okay. And so then to this question, I mean, it's supposed to be a pretty simple calculus, right? You spend the capital investment, then the robots essentially work for free, and they can work a lot more than human beings can, so productivity should go up.
Yeah, how could it not go up? I mean, you had 10 guys working in an assembly line putting cars together. Instead, you have one robot arm that puts the car together. Those 10 gentlemen who were on the assembly line can go somewhere else, find other jobs, do other things, and, you know, we should be able to make more stuff because the robot's making the cars. Those people can go make other things. Seems natural and inevitable, just isn't happening.
It's not. So where's the proof that that's not happening?
Well, so the government keeps a very good track of productivity numbers. That is, how much stuff we make for every hour worked. And the reason we keep track of it is it's probably the most important economic indicator. I mean, there are two things behind economic growth. One is the population growing? And the other is productivity growing? And the only way to get richer is for productivity to grow. So we keep a careful eye on it, and it's growing at the slowest rate in 50 years.
The slowest rate in 50 years?
Yes.
Okay. Let's put some more shape on these numbers. You cite a new paper from a couple of MIT economists that say that, for example, a matching figure for that productivity loss is job losses.
So, yeah, it's an amazing paper. And they tracked where the robots are showing up and then looked to see what's happening to jobs in the places where the robots are showing up. And the answer is nothing good. Robots, every time a robot shows up in town, about 5 to 6 people lose their jobs. And that's a net loss. That doesn't mean they lose their jobs and go get other jobs. That means they drop out of employment. They have no employment after that. It's a pretty dramatic effect. I mean, for me, the really surprising thing about the paper is no productivity growth. I always thought, oh, well, then this robot thing's just not happening yet. It's just not possible. The robot thing can't be happening if there's no productivity. But then this paper comes out, and actually the robot thing is happening, and it's displacing people. So that should definitely mean productivity growth, but no.
Okay, so
right.
So I feel like, forgive me for just being, maybe I'm just a little slow today, but how is that possible?
This is, I think, the most interesting question. There are a bunch of theories, and I'll go through my favorite one first. But there are people who will still say, there must be something wrong with the paper. There are people who will say, like, this really can't be. It's an impossible puzzle. It's more like a paradox. The paper's got to be wrong, or we'd have productivity growth. But maybe not. Here's another alternative. And I borrow this from Ryan Event, who writes for The Economist. Imagine a robot showed up tomorrow that could do the work of 30% of all people in the country, just one robot. Would that make us much, much more productive? Not really, because those people still need jobs. We don't have a very good social safety net. We don't have any system for them to survive without jobs. They would just fall into poverty. So what are they going to do? They're going to go get whatever jobs they can. And increasingly, available jobs are low productivity jobs. They're low wage jobs. And so there's a kind of offset. The robots are making some companies more productive, but the workers they're displacing are ending up in industries that have really, really low productivity, like, hey, can I go pick up your laundry for you and take it to your house? And the net effect is, no, people in general aren't better off.
Okay, so there, as you said, there's some pushback coming from different sectors about this assertion that robots aren't making the U.S. economy, at least, more productive. We have a little bit of tape here. This is David Otter. He's a professor of economics at MIT. And this is from a TED Talk that he gave in late 2016.
The fraction of U.S. adults employed in the labor market is higher now in 2016 than it was 125 years ago in 1890, and it's risen in just about every decade in the intervening 125 years.
Okay, so add to that Mark Andreessen. He said in 2016 that, quote, there are more net jobs in the world today than ever before, and hundreds of years of technological innovation and hundreds of years of people predicting the death of work. So the argument there is you take the long view. And, you know, maybe not today, but maybe 50 years today, we will see that productivity boost.
Yeah, that could very well happen. I will say before I get to answer that, one reason there are more net jobs is women can work. And that's less an economic story and more a sort of civil rights and women's rights story. But nevertheless, it is also true that up to now, every time there's been a big technological change, the economy has shifted in a way so that people did find things to do and ended up better off. Mm-hmm. Like, we could be in just the Luddite stage of the robot revolution, where handloom weavers are very angry that there are now power looms in their factory, so they go and burn them down. And they weren't wrong. Like, the power looms were not good for those people. And yet, the industrialization of England is the most important economic event ever. Before it, poverty was the default human condition, and after it, poverty was not the default human condition. That may happen with robots. Maybe we're in the early stages. People are not seeing the benefits. But 50 years from now, affluence and limitless leisure time will be the default human condition. So far, though, that's just a story.
Okay, so but there's even a dark side to a future of affluence and unlimited leisure time. I mean, I was telling the staff earlier today that I remember those scenes in WALL-E, right? In the movie WALL-E, where humankind isn't doing so well because it has nothing to do. But on a more serious note, we have another bit of tape here. To your point, Evan, this is Nigel Cameron, president of the Center for Policy on Emerging Technologies, again from a TEDx talk. This is from 2014, and he talked about how the future could be, you know, one without work thanks to robots. But then he added this thought:
is this a future which takes us to heaven on earth, in which we need not work? Or is it a future which takes us to hell on earth, in which we cannot work?
So, I mean, this, it sounds like a fantastical or crazed vision of the future. But if we're talking about, as you said, jobs aren't being transported or people aren't able to find equally satisfying or high paying work when they're displaced by robots, how does a society in which the future is one of many people unable to work going to function?
So I think this is sort of the biggest, most important long-term question of the robot revolution problem. That is, we've got to find a way for people to be happy. And work and the dignity of work has been a big part of human satisfaction for a very long time, and there isn't a good model. But it also seems like a pretty distant question for the moment. And there's a short-term version of it, which is, even before we get there, it would be nice to find things for today's robot-displaced workers to be doing with their time other than, as I said, picking up someone's laundry or driving people around in an Uber. And there are ways to tackle this, and the two may be connected. That is, the short-term solution could be connected to the long-term solution with something like a guaranteed basic income.
Okay.
You could imagine starting with that now and building that out into the future.
Well, one could also imagine with every passing year or couple of years, there's new sectors in which the robots are entering. I mean, you mentioned ride-hailing drivers. Once the self-driving vehicle comes along, they're all out of work too.
Yeah.
I mean, so to that point, one more piece of tape here. There's been a lot of people thinking about our robot future. And I want to play this for you. This is James Besson, lecturer at the Boston University School of Law. And he's the author of Learning by Doing, The Real Connection Between Innovation, Wages, and Wealth. He gave a talk at Google, of all places, earlier this year.
I'm going to, in fact, argue that the idea of the end of work in the near future, the next 10 or 20 years, isn't really the main challenge. The main challenge is generating the skills to work with a new technology on a social scale. So it's scarce skills, not scarce jobs.
So, Evan, I mean, on that point, in your research and talking to the economists that whose work underlies your article here, I mean, do you get a sense that they think we as a society are asking the right questions about how to deal with this future?
So I'll say two things. First, one of the really striking things about the paper we were talking about earlier, it's not just that low-skilled people lose their jobs when robots come to town. They couldn't find anybody who gained in terms of jobs or wages. So even people with postgraduate degrees, they weren't doing any better in the places where the robot's showing up. And that's surprising if you think the real challenge is we need to upskill and more people need to go to college. But college grads weren't doing very well either. So I don't know about that story. I also wanted to say, when I talked to people for this piece from from robotics trade groups, you know, you call people who sell these things or who manage consortiums of organizations who sell these things, and you ask them, like, hey, do you think you're ever going to be replaced by a robot?
Oh, dear.
Right? And they laugh it off like it's an absurd kind of question. But I don't think it is. Artificial intelligence is getting better. Robots are getting smarter. There will come for doctors' jobs and reporters' jobs. And, I mean, our conversation could easily be automated. You know, there's the old Simpsons joke where they just turn – I think it's a Simpsons joke. And the auto bot says, ooh, those boobs in Congress, ha, ha, ha. Right?
Yeah.
You can imagine such a thing a bit smarter than that. So I think in some ways it isn't just an upskilling problem and it's not just a future problem. It is a problem of finding productive things for all people to do. And it's a problem that's starting now if the robots have already come and they're putting people out of work and forcing them into low-paying jobs.
I mean, it's a real and I think pressing challenge for all of us in the future. But at least I'm glad to say that right now, both you and I had a human conversation. Evan Horowitz, he writes the Quick Study column for the Boston Globe that looks at data and policy issues in Massachusetts. His article about the robot revolution and productivity in the U.S. economy was in the Globe. We have a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. Evan, thank you so very much.
It was great. Thank you, Meghna.
Time now for the Remembrance Project, our weekly look at the extraordinary lives of ordinary people in our community. This morning, today, writer Alyssa Eli remembers a Brookline bookstore owner who was a true individualist.
Growing up in Sao Paulo, Brazil, Susana Michel's Portuguese nickname translated to Little No. It could also have translated to Little Rebellion. In Catholic school, she used to confess to elaborate sins, but the confessions were strictly for her own amusement, since the sins were non-existent. Also, Susana was Jewish. When her beloved older sister moved to Israel for college, Little No decided she needed to move to Israel, too. She maneuvered an expulsion from not one but two schools in Sao Paulo, and her exasperated parents finally sent her to a kibbutz for troubled youth. The vitality and rawness of that emerging country, Israel's own rebelliousness, spoke to her. Susanna thrived on joyful camaraderie. It was asking for trouble, of course, when she joined the army. Spirited backtalk led to many desert marches with extra weighted packs. But she made it clear to her daughter, Natalie Kingsbury, that this was a price, like others in her life, she willingly paid.
She used to say, she goes, it's so much better. You really should be like this. She goes, you're like a volcano. You explode, and then it's done. She literally advised me to be like a volcano because it was better. It was healthier.
The fearless non-traditionalist entered a more traditional chapter when she married an American military man. They moved around the country, Maryland, the Pacific Northwest, where she tried selling Avon cosmetics to other Army wives, but her accent was too thick for commerce. When Natalie was in sixth grade, Susanna followed another dream. She enrolled in college, eventually left the marriage, moved on to graduate school, and became a teacher. She fed and clothed immigrant students and relished a role as their sounding board. She had once been an immigrant herself. After Natalie moved to Boston, Susanna moved there too and opened a foreign language bookstore, Mundy International, in Coolidge Corner. She was fluent in seven languages, teaching her daughter to swear in all of them, and the vision of a gathering place for a multilingual community compelled her. But sometimes her independence interfered.
I don't always think that she was great in customer service. My mom was one of those people that you either loved or you didn't love. You know, if she wanted to close for the day, she would just flip the sign and say, I'm going home. And I'm like, Mom, you can't, it's a business. And she's like, well, I'm the owner and I'm done for the day.
Living with certainty and, when necessary, with dissent, never abandoned her. After Susanna was diagnosed with early dementia, she spoke French to the Haitian nurses and Spanish to the Latino nurses in the nursing home.
The last time I saw her, she said to me, Natalie, go! And then she went and laid in bed and turned around and said, I'm done talking to people now.
She was as good as her word and died several days later.
Susanna Michel died in Brookline in December. She was 70 years old. To suggest someone for remembrance, email remember@wbur.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be back. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Do you get tired of springing ahead and then falling back every year? Ending that tradition of seasonally resetting the clock could result in a little more light on winter evenings, which is why Massachusetts is one of several New England states considering sticking with daylight saving time year-round, as Fred Bever reports.
The concept of adjusting the clock to suit social needs appears to be Benjamin Franklin's, in a jesting bit of advice to the French to start their days earlier, work more during the sunny hours, and thereby save on candle wax. In 1962, our federal government standardized the practice of daylight saving time, and now 48 U.S. states deploy it in an effort to match work hours and sunlight. But here on the East Coast, it has its critics.
Christ, the minute you set that clock back and it's darker earlier, it's just,
Dean Pike owns the Moose Island Marine Shop in Eastport, Maine. It's the nation's easternmost city, and they see the sun first there, but they are also first to see it set. And from mid-November through early January, sundown comes before 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
In the fall, it just kills us. You know, it's better for us to have it lighter later. The problem is, if Maine does it alone, look at how that's going to affect, you calling your suppliers. It sure would be nice if it was a region-wide decision.
He could be in luck on that. Discontent with the current system can be found region-wide. Ask Keith Murphy, who moved to Bedford, New Hampshire, some 13 years ago.
And I remember moving in January, and it got dark at 4:15 p.m. And I was astonished, because that was not what I was used to.
Murphy happens to be a member of New Hampshire's legislature, and he introduced a bill back in the dark days of February that could end that state's annual clock hop and instead stay year-round with daylight saving time, also known in this region as Atlantic Standard Time. Murphy's bill has passed the New Hampshire House with a proviso that Massachusetts and Maine switch up too, and that the federal government gives permission. And similar measures have passed Maine's House and Senate, also with the proviso that neighbors act as well. In Massachusetts, a commission appointed by Governor Charlie Baker is set to make recommendations on the question within a month. Lawmakers in the rest of New England have at least submitted similar bills, although no one seems to be spending a lot of political capital on the issue. But it is about a lot more than early sunsets. A growing body of research shows that when we lose that hour of sleep each spring, we suffer a kind of jet lag.
Switching to daylight saving time, in particular during the spring, is problematic because it disrupts these circadian cycles that we have, And when it gives that shock to our system, we're not immediately able to change.
David Wagner is a sleep and workplace researcher at the University of Oregon's Lundquist Business College. He says that in the days just after the clocks are set forward, especially Sleepy Monday, many ills can result, with the rate of heart attacks and strokes rising, minors getting into more accidents, and drivers too. A decision-making patterns change. Wagner says judges tend to hand out harsher sentences, for instance. And at work,
it turns out that people cyberloaf more, which is using their computers for things that are not work-related, surfing the web. And we also found moral awareness decreases. People are not kind of tuned into the moral implications of various situations. We've got a current paper that we're working on looking at policing and prejudice that occurs in policing, and that's exacerbated under conditions of sleep deprivation.
But even with the mounting evidence of the problems posed by changing the clocks back and forth, there is a good deal of skepticism about changing the habit. In Maine, the Chamber of Commerce worries that business transactions, especially those with the financial capital of New York City, will be slowed, while shipping and travel between border states could get pretty confusing. And in northern New England, there can be a flinty reluctance to make decisions contingent on what heavyweight Massachusetts does. And for some people who start their workday early in the morning, like Benjamin King, a barista at Portland's Coffee by Design, the morning sun is a blessing they'd like to hold on to right through winter.
Because people want to start their day in the light versus, you know, the end of the day. We're used to it getting dark, so it really doesn't matter what time it gets dark.
King probably doesn't have to worry, at least for the moment. Maine Governor Paul LePage, known for his well-used veto pen, says the idea of changing the current system is, quote, an insane thought. But with research and lawmakers around New England increasingly highlighting problems with the practice, it could be just a matter of time.
That story from Fred Bever of the New England News Collaborative.
The Boston Celtics survive and advance to the Eastern Conference Finals. They were taken to the limit by the Washington Wizards. Boston takes game seven, 115-105.
Survive. They won. That's another word for what happened last night at the Garden when the Celtics defeated Washington in game seven of the Eastern Conference Finals, which means Eastern Conference semifinals. I'm going to get this right. Next stop, the finals versus LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers. And here to discuss is WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Hello, Shira.
Hello.
Okay, so people are saying that this is an improbable run by the Celtics. Is it?
I don't think so. I mean, let's not forget they are the number one seed in the East, albeit, you know, a weak number one seed. We all know that the Cleveland Cavaliers should have been the number one seed, but they're still a good team with one very good player in Isaiah Thomas, who can completely take over a fourth quarter, it seems, when need be. So this is, you know, they're no pushovers, though they did get off to a bit of a shaky start, dropping two to Chicago and then, you know, having some trouble with Washington. But they should be there in the Eastern Conference Finals. I don't know if they'll challenge the Cleveland Cavaliers much.
Yeah, I mean, so you're being the realistic sports journalist here.
I should be, right?
I'm just going to be the blind fan and say, of course they will. I mean, so let's talk about, I mean, you mentioned Isaiah Thomas, but let's also talk about one of the heroes of last night's game, right? Kelly Olynyk?
I was going to say, you'll never guess. Like anybody who follows the Celtics, they would have never guessed that Kelly Olynyk would be hero of game seven. I mean, he's the 7-foot backup center for the Celtics, and he scored like 14 points in the fourth quarter to basically seal the victory. I mean, it was like three-pointers, drive to the basket. I mean, whatever you needed, Kelly Olynyk was there. And usually that's Isaiah Thomas's role, but he took over for Isaiah Thomas.
Okay, so we have tape of Olynyk speaking after the game. And yeah, sorry, Celts fans, I totally screwed up the pronunciation of his name. But
it's okay. A lot of people, I think he floats under the radar. He goes under the radar.
Well, not anymore, right?
It's hard as a 7-footer, but he does.
So here he is. He talked about some words of encouragement he got before last night's game.
Frank called me this morning and, you know, told me, you know, the thing you got to be at your best when your best is needed. And, you know, our best was needed tonight, and everybody gave it their best, and it turned out for us.
So you're going to keep your eyes on him as in the Eastern Conference Final then?
Yeah, I mean, I'll keep my eyes on him. I'll keep my eyes on Isaiah Thomas. I'd like to see a little bit more from Avery Bradley. I'll keep my eyes on Marcus Smart. I mean, I'd be pretty surprised. This was, I think it was a career high, playoff career high for Olynyk at 26 points total for the game. I'd be surprised if he duplicates that against the Cavaliers. But, hey, stranger things have happened.
Yeah. So one more thing before we move on to other sports news. I want to talk about the fact that lots of people, and even you had a little bit of this earlier, were kind of like, yeah, they're the Celtics are the number one seed in the Eastern Conference. Maybe they shouldn't be. And Isaiah Thomas himself had some words about that in the postgame interview last night.
They didn't give us a chance in this series. They didn't give us a chance when we was down 2-0 to the Chicago. They don't ever give us a chance, and we just keep going. We don't care about what others say.
Okay, so respond to that.
Well, can I just say this is like a time-honored tradition among athletes? I mean, remember when the Patriots were cruising to the Super Bowl? Like, nobody respects them. The world is against them. I mean, this is what athletes do to get motivated. They're the underdogs. They don't get any respect. You know, nobody expected them to do this. Though I do think the Celtics have more of a case than most teams in that respect. People did say, well, yeah, they got the number one seed by being consistent mm-hmm. throughout. You know, they didn't, and they thought, well, maybe Washington would present a challenge or more of a challenge. It did go to seven games. Yeah, the Cleveland is still...
Cleveland's still Cleveland.
Cleveland is still Cleveland.
Cleveland still got LeBron James.
I was going to say, yeah, there's a guy named LeBron James. okay. He's a handful. Newsflash.
Okay. Well, we'll see. I'm still rooting for the Celtics.
I mean, it'd be interesting to see if they could take it, a six or seven games.
Yeah.
Listen, when you are the number one seed, that comes with home court advantage. So any game seven would be back in the Garden, and that's a tough place to play.
So let's hope for that, okay?
Yes.
All right, now let's move on here, because this June marks the 45th anniversary of Title IX, and of course that was the legislation that prohibits educational institutions from making any kind of discrimination on the basis of sex. Now, you're going to be moderating a discussion tonight about Title IX, right?
I am, over at Radcliffe. It's co-hosted or co-sponsored by WBUR and Radcliffe, and we are going to be talking with Attorney General Maura Healey, former WNBA player and current WNBA executive Swin Cash. You might remember her from her UConn year. She's also a two-time Olympic gold medalist, a three-time WNBA champion, and rower Jevi Stone. I guess we should now say Dr. Jevi Stone, because she'll be starting her residency at Beth Israel Deaconess. She was a silver medalist in rowing at the 2016 Rio Olympics.
Yeah. So, I mean, so 45 years of Title IX, there's an entire generation represented in the women you're going to talk to, and yourself, honestly, who came up in this world where schools were not allowed to say you can't play because you're a woman or your gender. I mean, how much of a difference did it make? Has it made?
It made a huge difference. I mean, you look at the way that U.S. women dominate international sports, whether it's the U.S. women's soccer team winning the World Cup, the U.S. women's ice hockey team winning the World Championship, and then the gold at when the sport debuted in the Olympics in 1998. Across the board, I think it's the reason U.S. women excel both nationally and internationally in sports. But I think it's sort of like there's like a misconception that the work is done, mm-hmm. or maybe a myth that the work of Title IX is done. Like, oh, great, everybody has equality of opportunity. Well, that was, to me, only a first step. And I think what we're going to talk about tonight is sort of what needs to happen in the future and where we're lagging behind. A lot was made recently of pay inequality with the women's soccer team and the women's hockey team, mm-hmm. national teams. But there are also other things that are happening in women's sports that I think people don't realize. Girls drop out of high school sports at twice the rate of boys. Why is that happening, and what can we do about it? Issues like that. Women often have inferior facilities. For the Women's World Cup in 2015, they played on turf fields. There are a lot of issues like that that I think, you know, we need to really keep discussing it. What, you know, women and sports and equality.
So I wonder if this will come up tonight at the event that you're going to be hosting, Shira, because, I mean, one way to measure I'd say the success of Title IX is the pushback that it's also gotten. You know, one small example is that some schools, you know, in order to meet the equitable requirements for women's teams, they've had to fold some men's teams for smaller sports, and they've
wrestling
gotten a lot of got a lot of pushback for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is one measure of success, but also these schools, if they want to, they can, you know, they can find a way. I don't think, you know, Title IX should not be blamed for sports, men's sports disappearing. Where there's a will, there's a way, I think. And sometimes at the college level, the easier choice is to drop men's programs to create a balance. It's also a question of money and funding, and that all comes into it too.
Yeah, so remind us once again, where and when is this talk tonight?
It's at 7 p.m. There's a reception ahead of time at 5:30 if you want something to eat, and it's at Radcliffe. It will be at the Knopfle Center on the Radcliffe campus out in Cambridge.
Okay, great. We'll have more information about that and a link to it at radioboston.org. Shira Springer is WBUR Sports and Society reporter. Thank you so much, Shira.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.